Schindler. Thank you. Dearly beloved brethren. Wrong show. My name is Roy Hart and I'm an alcoholic. Oh, no, that's the wrong show. That reminds me, what a great title for a collection of anecdotes. Now, everyone in show business has their own favourites, and when I think about it, the stories my fellow performers tell about each other is probably the reason I've stayed in the game for the past 40 years, you know. And now, as I'm here on my Todd right now, I think I've had to find somewhere reminding myself of some of the stories, so I've jotted down just a few names that hopefully will spark off some memories for you. Now, I have to start by telling you how I came into show business in the first place, and I was brought up in Croydon, and I was brought up by my granny. Croydon, and my advice to any of you is if you're going to be brought up by anyone, get brought up by your gran. You know, they're marvellous, they're such a soft touch gran, you know. And she was a terrific gran because she brought the pair of us up on an old age pension, which was about £2.17 and sixpence in those days. But she always found that every Tuesday night we had to go to the Croydon Empire. She was a great fan of variety, so we were always there every Tuesday night, which was carnival night, and that meant about three balloons came down, you know. Some carnival, you know. And the manager used to stand on stage with a mirror and go round and the band used to play. He'd stop, you know, he'd get a box of Dairy Milk chocolate, you know, for that. Never where we were always up in the gods and my grand leaning over. Up here, mate, up here. Yeah. Never got up that far. But I always remember that because the front of the sort of seats we sat in the gallery there, were whitewashed. And whenever we used to go, just before we were going out into the street, my grand always used to say, turn round. And I used to turn around, she'd go, and she'd wipe the whitewash off the back of her shoes like that. And she'd say, I don't want people knowing I can only afford the gods. And we used to go. But she was a lovely lady, and she was a great fan of comedians. And one of her favourites of all time was Frankie Howard, you know, when he first sort of came round. And she always used to say, if a comic amused her, she used to say, ah, you silly bugger, she used to say, I like him, you know. And it was a great place to see turns, you know, it was just after the war, because we had a lot of the old music hall stars, and they were all together with a new wave of comics, people who had really nothing to do with the business, but all their sort of humour had been spawned by being in the forces. And so you had on the bill people, you'd have G.H. Eliot and Hetty King and Randolph Sutton, you know, on the bill with people like Max Bygraves and Harry Secombe. I'll never forget seeing Harry Secombe. He did it, which I thought was a terrifically original act at the Croydon Empire. He did different people shaving, you know, different people shaving. He went very well at Croydon. It didn't go so well at Bury, apparently, he told me, because he was paid off after the first performance. And the manager said, off you go, you can shave in your own bloody time. He said, isn't it funny how I'm sure a lot of you, they say you can remember certain little jokes and certain lines that comics did all those years ago. And I always remember Harry Worth, who I thought was a terrific comic and a great variety act. And I always remember he used to come at the end of the act and he'd say, you've been marvellous, ladies and gentlemen, you really have. You know, the last time I played Croydon, he said, I came out of the stage door and there was a huge crowd waiting for me and they picked me up and they put me on their shoulders. And I said, are you taking me to the town hall? They said, no, you're for the river. They were great days, and there were some great original comedians. Spike, of course, Spike Milligan, Michael Benteen, which reminds me again that I started doing shows in a boys' club. Now, and I joined this boys' club in Croydon, and you had to join. I wanted to play table tennis, and you had to sign for what they called an improving activity as well. You know? And improving activities were very exciting things like leather work and metal work, you know, and car maintenance and all that. And you know, I'm going down this stuff. I thought, he said, you've got to pick one, you know. So I go right at the bottom, concert party. And I thought, boy, that's me, you know. And I couldn't have been luckier because the chap who ran it, him and his wife, they'd both been pros for 40 years and they'd retired and they did the shows. And we always used to do a big charity show every year at Streatham Hill Theatre to raise money for the club. And we always used to open up the boys in the concert party. Used to do about 10 minutes. And as I come off, the next turn on, and then he used to have hair out here and a great big beard, was Michael Benteen. And he used to do it with the back of a chair, do you remember? And he used to sort of, it was a prison, then it was a, you know, a road driller thing and all. He had a great big inner tube he used to use in his act for no reason. And he picked up this inner tube, folded it in half, and said, quick impression, Tessie O'Shea in full retreat. we came off from the thing, and Benty grabbed me just as he was going on. He said, "That was very funny, son. You know," he said, "you ought to do this for a living." And I never forgot it. And literally about 40 years later, I met Michael for the first time since then, you know. And I told him the story. He said, "That's right, blame me." But this dotting down of headings might work here. It reminded me of a true story. So I thought I'd try a few alphabetically to write them down. Arthur Askey, of course. Now, Arthur, I had the great joy of working with him in Panto, and in a very odd way. I'd had a terrible year. Everything had gone wrong for me in this particular year. I was my first radio series didn't work out. First television series for ITV, that was no good. And I did a play at the Garrick with Rita Touchingham and Dan Dinner, who was run 6 nights, you know. So it was looking very good at the beginning of that year. And I couldn't get arrested, as we say, you know. So I'm sitting at home there for about 8 months out of work. My agent's ringing up and he's saying, "Oh, can't you give him a Sunday concert or anything, you know?" And they're saying, "No, no, he's box office poison and all that." Anyway, eventually Billy Marsh, his famous, you know, sort of manager and an agent, came on to my agent and he said, "Would Roy be interested in doing Wimbledon for Christ?" "Would I? I only live down the road, so I can walk there, you know, marvellous, I'll be there." And it was with Arthur. And I only found out afterwards I'd never ever met Arthur in my life. I just admired him as, I think, one of the great innovators, really, of all time. And Arthur, they'd rung him about the Panto at Wimbledon, and he said, "Yes, I would be happy to do it, but only if Roy Halley's in it as well. Because we work together marvellously in pantomime, we really do. And it would be a huge help to me." He knew I was in trouble and he got me a job. And people say in our business, what mean people they are. Not really, not old Arthur, he was lovely. He started in concert parties as well, Arthur, of course, and he started on a bandstand in Cliftonville in Margate. And he said in those days, you know, they always dress up as the Pieros and everything. And I'm sure a lot of you have read, even if you don't remember, but they used to have the bandstand shows and they'd say, "If wet, in the town hall." Arthur said, "We got nowhere to go if it was wet. If it was wet, we didn't play." You know, it was just this great big bandstand at Cliftonville. He said, "So we start off," he said, "and we get down there, June." He said, "June's not bad." Now, July, he said, "It poured with rain for the whole of July, and we hardly did a show." He said, "Now, August, the sun comes out, and it's great." He said, "And the guy who ran the show invented the one-string fiddle for no reason at all." He said, "And he's sitting up there, and we're all in a line on the bandstand. 3,000 people on the bandstand at Cliftonville." He said, "And he's had a marvellous lunch, the old boy, around a concert party, and he's nodded off in the afternoon, you know." And the soprano finished her first number three, and she said, "Now I'd like to sing for you, ladies and gentlemen, April Was a Lady." And he said, "The old boy opened one eye and said, 'But July was a bastard.'" You ever get the chance to read Arthur's life story? It's a terrific one. A story, I don't know if it's in the book or not, but one Arthur used to tell us was just after Dunkirk, and he was in a big show in Blackpool, his own show, and there was a military hospital in Preston, and he took the whole show there one afternoon. That was the orchestra, the sets, the costumes, everything, and he did the whole show for the guys who were in this hospital, you see, in Preston, this military hospital. And at the end of the show, the commandant said, "Oh," he said, "Mr. Askey," he said, "wonderful of you to bring this terrific show and to give up your afternoon off." And Arthur said, "Well, nothing's too good for the lads who did what they did at Dunkirk." And the commandant said, "Dunkirk," he said, "the furthest they've ever been is Blackpool, this lot." He said, "This is the VD hospital." Go down this again. Ida Barr, I broke down Ida Barr here, who I just remember seeing at the Met Edgware Road, and an old musical star who, "Oh, You Beautiful Doll," was her big number, big hit number. And she, like all those lady stars, a great big woman, you know. Huge she was. She used to tell a story, sitting in her dressing room, and two blokes talking outside the dressing room in the street. And it was just before the second show started. One said, "Have you seen the show?" He said, "Yeah." He said, "What's it like?" He said, "Not bad." He said, "How about that Ida Barr?" He said, "Ida Barr, she could hide a bleeding brewery." Billy Bennett, of course, you know, one of my great heroes, the man who invented the boom boom joke. "Some girls are all right in a bath marble white, doused in perfume that's exotic. But the queen of my soul stands up in a bowl and does what she can with carbonic." Now, oh, here's a name that always reminds me of lots of stories. Alan Breeze. Now, Alan Breeze, I'm sure a lot of you remember Al Breezy with Billy Cotton's band show, you know. And the first television I ever did from London was the Billy Cotton band show. I remember getting there, and I'd always been an admirer of Breezy, you know, because he could do everything. He could handle the comedy songs, the ballads, everything. And we got there, and there was two of us brand new, never been on the telly really before. And one was a Welsh singer, and we shared the dressing room. Alan said, "Come and share the dressing room with us." And at the end of it, he said, the Welsh singer, he said, "I think you've got chances." It was Tom Jones. It was the first the first one you'd have to do, oh, breezy, saucy devil. I think you've got chances, you know. But the great thing about Alan, which a lot of people don't know, he was a terrible stutterer, Alan. Now, this apparently does happen to a lot of people. When he sang, he could sing perfectly all right, you know, no problems at all. But when he actually spoke, he could not put two words together. It was murder. And he had a pub, you know, which the Buck in it was called, Never Pass the Buck. He used to have one of the big... But, I mean, when you got there, it really was awful in serving people, you know. But it didn't worry him. But it was this terrible start. Once he started to sing, terrific. And he got done for speeding, see. So they bring him up, and he's going to fight the case, Alan. Because he says, no, it wasn't speeding, you know. So he says, I'm going to go in the court, and I'm going to fight the case. Well, all the band went with him. They couldn't wait, you know, to see what he was going to do, you know. So he gets there, and the judge said, well, tell me in your own words exactly what happened, Mr. Breeze. He said, well, I was going down the... Over he goes, and they're all getting rested. He said, Your Honour, he said, could I possibly sing my evidence? The judge looked at him, he said, yeah, all right, then. So he said, take your... I'm proceeding down the road at 70 miles an hour, we're out of the side where he came and up your mark, and off he went, you know. The whole bloody thing, you judge, case dismissed, I should think. That was breezy. I got Tommy Cooper written down, of course, Brother Walter. Tommy Cooper, I mean, there's classics of Tommy. I mean, the most famous one of all was him at the Royal Variety Performance, saying to the Queen, you know, after the show, and she said, thank you very much, Mr. Cooper, it was very nice. And so she walked away, and he did the unforgivable thing. He called her back, you know. He said, Mom, did you? He said, forgive me, he said, but, he said, are you interested in football at all? And she said, no. He said, can I have your cup final ticket? And you talk to any taxi driver in London, they'll all say, I had that Tommy Cooper in here, you know. He said, he got out of the cab, put something in my top pocket, said, have a drink of meat, tea bag. Said, tea bag. Did it to everybody. With these now, Billy Dainty, my best friend, Billy Dainty. Yeah, a lovely guy. And we did a show together called Just a Verse and Chorus, just before old Billy knocked it on the head. But he was a dear, dear chap, you know. And I always remember when Billy died, the letters I had from people, you know, who remembered him very well. And there was a lady wrote to me, and I remember this happening so well. He was doing a summer season at Torquay with Harry Worth. And Billy never failed, you know. His act was absolutely fireproof. He was a terrific performer and all that. So he gets in, it's the opening night at Torquay, and he goes like a bomb, and he's sweating like a lunatic, you know. And he's dancing and everything. And he took his call like that, and he'd had a little piece made. He had a little ball batch in the middle there, but and he had a little piece made, and as he took his call, it dropped off onto the stage. And a hush went over the audience, and he leaned over, picked it up, looked at it, and he said, oh, well, you may as well know the lot, and took his teeth out. Good old Bill. As you know, he was a marvellous dancer, and he relied very much on all the drums for his effects, you know, for all the eccentric dancing he used to do. And a great buddy of ours, another brother, Walter, Len Lowe, was his straight man, you know, at one time. And they got, when they were playing the clubs, they got to one of these clubs, and the fella said, can I have a word with the drummer? He said, we haven't got a drummer. Billy said, but I don't, you know, what are you doing? He said, got to have the drums. He said, well, we haven't got any drums. So Len said, don't worry. And Len, well, the fella played the piano, and Len played the drum part on his body. Any port in a storm, you know. I've got Diggs, I've got written down here, Diggs. Loads of stories about them, but my story about Diggs is really, it's a tragic story. It was in a university town, which shall be nameless, because the lady involved is still around, I tell you. I was doing a panto there with a pal of mine, and we got these Diggs, but it was all students, mostly, you know, during the year. But they were all gone away home, you know, for Christmas. So we had these Diggs. And we got in there, and it was right under the eaves. And we got out there, and an awful smell when we got out there in these Diggs. And my pal picked up the electric fire and ran it over these sheets, and they steamed, you know, it was horrible. It was awful. And, yes, it was supper as well. We got supper as well. Every night we came back from these rehearsals, baked beans. And that was all. That was all. Just a plate full of baked beans every night. She must have had, from World War I, tins of this stuff up there. You know. This was it, baked beans. So. And in those days, you know, no sort of real equity rules. You know, they didn't sort of say, you've got to finish after 8 hours or anything like that. You used to actually go on and carry on rehearsals and lighting and things like that until you'd finished. And we were there, and it was about 2:30 in the morning. And they've finished the dress rehearsal. They've done all the lighting and everything. And me and Tom, my pal, we're walking back to the Diggs. And I've got the red mist now. now, you know. I'm saying, if it's bloody baked beans. So they're going down that passage after her, I tell you. Bloody baked beans, you know, so we get there. So we're here, you know. Shuffle, shuffle, the old carpet slippers coming along the, you know, thing. Two great big plates of bloody baked beans. Look at this. I've got me fork and I start poking about in there. There's a sausage in it. There's a sausage in the middle of these baked beans, you know. And I've really got the redness and I say, oi, sit down the corridor. There's something's wrong here. I said, there's a sausage in the middle of these baked beans. She said, I know. Merry Christmas. She's probably still bloody letting them and still giving them baked beans. I've got a name down here that may not mean much to a lot of you. It's very well known in his day. It was a chap called Leslie Dwyer, you know. His last sort of thing, I suppose, was really he was the miserable old Punch and Judy man. Yeah, in Heidi High, yeah. But he was in all those 40s and 50s films, you know, always as a cab driver, or he was sort of like the second string Gordon Harker, you know. That was him. And we were doing a play together on the road, and I'd never done much at all, really, you know, but we were in this play together, and we were in digs, and he said to me one night, he said, I'll tell you a fortune for you, if you like, you know. So I said, oh, okay, you know, and free, you know. So we started talking, and he said, now, I'm going to write this down for you, so I'm going to write these letters down for you. He said, they're going to mean something to you. He said, NSMAPMAWOL. That's going to mean something to you, very important. You know, I thought, okay. So I put it in me and my wallet, this little slip of paper, and 6 months later, absolutely true, I did a first television programme that I'd ever done regularly, and it was called Not So Much a Programme, More a Way of Life. And it was exactly the initial that Leslie had written. So there, spooky, eh? Spooky. Spooky. The great story, well, you know, the name under G again, a classic name, Eddie Gray, Monsieur Eddie Gray, you know. The great man, the funniest man probably in the whole of the Crazy Gang. During the Second World War, they all went, the Crazy Gang all went in two cars, you know, to entertain at one of these RAF camps, he said. And it's pitch black, you know, there was no lighting on or anything like that. He said, and we get to this RAF camp, they won't let us in. He said, and Chessie said, but it's the Crazy Gang. He said, yeah, 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 well, just a minute. And Eddie was in the car behind him, well, the window down, and he said, we have come for the plans of the Blenheim bomber. And the policeman said, oh, let them in, that's the Crazy Gang. Got another name. H written down here, Michael Harvey. Now, Michael Harvey was a chap who worked with me for about 10 or 15 years, Mike, and he was an old dancer in the West End shows, and he really knew everything there was possibly to know about show business, but he was terrific company. But the first time I ever did an impression of Max Miller was on the 50th anniversary of the RAF, and it was a show that we did live from the Victoria Palace, and we got there, and it was all people who'd been in the RAF for this 50th anniversary. And we got, and one of the guys who was one of the compares, it was Richard Burton. In the afternoon rehearsals, he comes in with Elizabeth Taylor, don't he? And they have a trick row. And I remember banging through that door, you know, where you press the bar exit. Bang, she goes through there. Not to be seen again, you know. And it comes to the show that night, and Burton's out there doing a bit of comparing, and he's standing in one of the boxes, and he's had a few, and there's two coppers. One's holding his right leg, and one's holding his left leg, and he's standing there in the box like this. Then Lord Tedder, and all this, you see. He gets through that, and he's standing there in the line, and he's going like this, and we're waiting for the Duke to come, and he looks along the line, Burton, he said, has anybody seen my wife? And Michael said, I'm not sure, what does she look like? Earlier I was saying about doing the impression of Max Miller, and of course, after being a terrific fan of Max's all my life, really because of my gran, you know, was a great fan of Max, and she would drag us to all the, you know, London music halls, variety theatres to see Max. And I mean, you know, people say a dirty comic he was and all that. I mean, I was about 7 or 8, and my gran used to take me there. She knew it would go over my head, but she knew that I liked this man, you know, and his fantastic costume and the hat and everything, and he was larger than life, you know, was a dangerous man, you know, great. So anyway, that's how we sort of got to know Max. And then I did actually get the joy of working with the Finsbury Park Empire with G.H. Eliot and Hetty King. And we were first on after the girls, the Mari de Vere dancers. And so on we go, and we're doing our thing. And then about the Wednesday night, I look in the wings like that. We only did 8 minutes. And Max is standing there watching us, you see. The great man himself, I can't believe it. So we come off, and he said, very good, that boy's very good. He said, I like that Shakespeare bit you did at the end. That was supposed to be take off of Noel Coward, you know. But he said, Shakespeare, lovely, that was, you know. So he said, boys, come on, I'll get you a drink. Ghastly hush, you know, all over the place. Because, I mean, this was Max's great thing. He never bought people a drink. He was famous for it, you know, he really was. And like a lot of the comics, he came from a very, very poor background. And that's the reason why so many of them are mean, because they've never had any money. They've seen what their parents were, and they want to hang on to it, you know. And Max was worse than most. He hung on to it till his knuckles went white. You know? So we said, well, I can't believe it. He says, come on, boys. So we go up to the Circle Bar, the show's still on, you know, and everything. And the two of us sat down there, me and Eddie, my partner, and he's talking about the business and all this, Max, and no sign of the hand going to the pocket at all. So I said, I looked at Eddie and I said, well, what would you like, Mr. Miller? Have I asked Charlie for a drink or not? Yeah, well, then sit down, you know. So he goes on talking. Another 20 minutes, Eddie says, what would you have, Mr. Miller? Please, boys, now I asked you out for a drink. So we sit there, another 2 minutes goes by, interval. And the bar doors open at the interval, and all the audience come in. And the first one in says, there he is, there's old Max. What will you have, Max? He said, I'll have a gin and tonic. What will you have, Roy? What will you have, Max? He waited 45 minutes for that, you know, rather than put his hand in his pocket, you know. The classic Paddo story really is the Tom O'Connor one, you know, which I'm sure you may have heard. And it was Tom playing pantomime in his hometown in Liverpool. And they're doing the ghost gag. You know, if you see the ghost boys and girls, you will tell me, won't you? You know. So he's there, and they're all shouting out, he's back on you, he's behind you, he's behind you, and all this and here. For this, no reason at all, this particular matinee, there's a very posh boys' school in the front two rows of the stalls. And in the middle of all this chaos, there was a moment's silence, and this very posh voice said, don't shout anymore, Charles, the man's obviously an idiot. For the last 11 years of pantomime, I had the great joy of working all those 11 years with Jack Tripper, the greatest pantomime dame I've ever had the pleasure of working with. And 1 year, well, it wasn't when I was with Jack, but 1 year he was in panto with Ivan Owen, as the chap who works Basil Brush. And as you always did on the Monday, you sort of have a little get-together about an hour before the curtain went up and all discuss what you've been doing, you know, the weekend and everything. And they're sitting there in the dressing room, and Ivan Owen said, well, he said, a dreadful weekend. He said, I got back to the house, he said, and we'd been burgled, broken into, he said. But you know, he said, I searched from top to bottom of the house. They hadn't taken a single thing. And Jack said, how humiliating. Well, he got down to the M's, and I better knock on the head now, because this year, I'm delighted to tell you that I celebrate, well, myself and Chris Emmett particularly celebrate 25 years of Radio 2's news headlines, folks, at the end of the year. Yes, thank you. And Chris has been in with it from day one, because we were dead lucky in the early days. We had Janet Brown, you know, as our comedian, you know, that did the greatest Margaret Thatcher of all time. And then following her, we had, for 7 years, we had Alison Steadman, who's, you know, become such a terrific actress and a wonderful film star. And so June Whitfield, this is how June came to be in this show, and she's only been with it 14 years, you know, so she stands a chance, I think, you know, she's one of the up-and-comers, you know, and we're doing a panto, we were, in Richmond. It was Dick Whittington, and I was hired with Jack. Jack was the first time I worked with Jack Tripp, was Sarah the cook. The fairy was June Whitfield, and we're sitting there in the dressing room, and June and I got on very well, you know, and we're sitting in the dressing room one night, and she said, what are you doing when you finish here then? And I said, oh, we're doing some more headlines, you know. And I said, you know, it's terrible. I said, Janet's gone, I said, and Alison's become a film star. And I said, and we've tried every girl in radio, and we can't, no one seems to quite fit it. And June said, well, I've done a bit of radio, you know. I said, no. What about the old glums and all that, mate? I said, this is modern, this is, mate. I said, you know, this is satire, this is, isn't it? I said, you've got to be able to do impressions and all that, June, you know. I said, I reckon you do Margaret Thatcher, you stand a bit of a chance, you know. She said, oh, you know. So the next matinee, we're in there, and she's got to referee the fight between the cat and the rat, you see. So we're all at this thing like this, and she says, right, now go to your corners and come out fighting. I said, June, you've got the job. That was 14 years ago, so she's got it, you know. I had a great joy, again, of about 3 or 4 years ago, of doing a version for television of P.G. Woodhouse's Heavy Weather. And, God, it was marvellous. And I played Beach the Butler, a gem of a part, with Peter O'Toole, Richard Briers, a terrific cast. And also in it was Richard Johnson, who's one of my very favourite actors of all time. And I can only tell you, it was a joy to be with people like Peter O'Toole, because he is the brightest, most intelligent, greatest company in the world. And he loved the old variety stories like I've been telling you today, you know, so we got on like a house on fire. And Richard Johnson always used to sit there, never say a word, just chuckle away at the jokes, you know. And he said, well, do you know, he said, I've only got one. It's one that I can tell you. He said, concerning my dear friend David Niven. Now, he said, David Niven had a sort of running gag. And when people used to say to him, tell me, Dave, when he's making a film, what's the new leading lady like? You know what I mean, Dave? He always used to reply, the best lover I've had since Grace Kelly, he used to say. So he's always got him out of trouble, you know. So he'd always do this. So he said, he now, Dave has been saying this line for years, and he's now in Monaco playing golf with Prince Rainier, you see. And they're off around the course, and he's going to make this film, and he says, tell me, David, he said, what is the new leading lady like? He said, the greatest lover I've had since Grace See Fields. Thank you very much for having me, folks. I hope you've enjoyed it. Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you, thank you. Thank you, you're most kind. Welcome to the show. That reminds me, this